This is Hour of the Wolf, a Wednesday morning program of science fiction, fantasy, and related fields of endeavor. My name is Jim Freund. With us this morning, writer N.K. Jemisin. Well, you know, for those who know, that's enough to say, stay tuned. Episode 3 of a reboot of Hour of the Wolf. And I have to say, I mean, how thrilling is it to follow Bob Fass and Robert Knight talking together? If there's anything that is emblematic of what is cool about WBAI, and yeah, there are a few things, just a few, but that's one of them. That's two of them between Bob and Bob. Well, Robert and Bob. I've never really thought of Robert Knight as a Bob. Robert Fass, yeah. Bob Knight, no. Anyhow, good morning. I am James Freund. This is Hour of the Wolf. And it's not the time. I have to explain this every week because it sounds wrong. Hour of the Wolf is the time between night and dawn, okay? It occurs somewhere between 5:30 and 6:30 a.m., actually sometimes much later, depending on where you are. It is called Vargtimen. It's a northern, like Swedish and whatever concept. There's a movie called Hour of the Wolf. That's where the title of the show comes from. It's a film directed by Ingmar Bergman, and it's actually available on, not on YouTube, but it's available on Google Video. You can go to Google Video and see the entire film legally. There. Hi, Robert. You see, now you've never been Bob Knight, right?
You know, last time I was ever Bob was when I was a systems analyst and they were putting me on a project to sell some Kruger Rands, and I said, no, no, no.
I remember when some joker
I became Robert
donated to WBAI 10 Krugerrands just to see what we would do with it. Because it was blood money.
Well, I don't
And the station manager said, take it to the bank and cash it.
I think it's brilliant because Bob Fass is one of my heroes. And Jim, I don't know if you remember, but aside from Pepsi Charles, the proximate cause and blame for my entry into BAI also belongs to you. Because when I was an egg, I came in because you offered a premium back in the antediluvian days.
As opposed to the pro-diluvian days.
A Broadway poster drawn and signed by the great comics artist who did Batman than anybody ever did, Neil Adams.
Yeah! So that show.
So you're to blame for my presence, too?
Cool. But did you ever see the show? Did you ever see the Broadway?
No, I missed that. But I got the better gift.
Mm. Those posters were the best premium I ever had.
Yeah. Well, listen, it's your show.
Books by N.K. Jemisin notwithstanding.
I just wanted to say I appreciate your precision about the description of the true meaning of The Hour of the Wolf. And it just occurred to me.
We both do time-based titles.
That the...
5 O'Clock Shadow.
That the... you see, he's so smart. That's what Hour of the Wolf is the, and I think this is the correct word, is the antipodes of the 5 O'Clock Shadow.
Oh, my God. Yes, it is. It is.
My man.
There you go. Okay. So everybody watching your radio, we're hugging or something.
No! My brother.
Yeah, which is why they cut part of his show to put me on.
Oh, gotcha.
Well, it's what happened. It's what happened. This, you know, he's on till 2 a.m., you know. It's, mm-hmm. You know.
This is a good
But they wanted to give me more than an hour.
You see, the good of the many is greater than the good of the one.
Okay, well, that has been used way too often.
Way too much.
I mean, this is like Obi-Wan stuff you're passing off here. At any rate, yeah, I mean, it's a fabulous segue. However long the shows are, it's a fabulous segue. I mean,
I love it.
I saw you wearing your pods in your ear, so I assume that you heard what
Bluetooth
I said.
From my wristwatch cell phone.
Oh my God!
Phone.
Yes. Yeah. This is that's real. He has he has an Android based wristwatch.
Really?
Yeah.
Well, you should make it like
Jim's
a Dick Tracy watch.
Oh, it is. It already is a Dick Tracy watch.
Okay. The two-way radio. It can actually be used as a two-way radio. That's so amazing.
Yes. We're finally caught up with half a century ago.
Right.
Yes, exactly. Oh, more than that? No.
More.
That. What is that? 36?
Samuel Gould or Dick Tracy, the artist, right?
Hmm. It's Gould. Oh, Chester.
Gould.
Chesterfield. No, it's earlier. It's earlier because those horrible, horrible movies with Ralph Byrd are the 30s. The serials are in the 30s. That's right, exactly. Everybody pulling the cap in Bob Fosse fashion here. Okay, I should get our show started. Now Nora's just like wandering all over the place. She's got nothing to do on the air because we're just geeking away. She got her new Murph. Yeah, you have your Murph with you?
Well, I haven't named it yet, actually.
I've named mine Edwin Droid.
Edwin Droid?
Edwin Droid, after Charles Dickens.
I'm going to have to come up with a name for mine, because I name all of my gadgets.
I also call it, and this is appropriate for Hanukkah, of which this is the last day, a droidal.
Okay.
I don't like your spin on that.
Oh, no. Well, let's see which way it comes up. But
I'm not supposed to know that, you know.
Says who? I mean, we have a friend by the name of K. Tempest Bradford, who's also a really good science fiction writer and computer person. And I was at a computer trade show function where she's an editor at Laptop Magazine.
Mm-hmm.
And somebody broke a glass. It fell down with a huge thing.
I hope.
And the first thing she's – and everybody's like, what was that? And she shouts out to the world, Mazel Tov!
Yeah!
It was a great moment. It was a great moment.
All right, y'all be brilliant. I'm out of here. Good night.
Okay.
See you later.
Take care, Robert. And by the way, freeform live radio should just blend like that. Are the headphones not?
One ear is.
Oh, yeah. Well, take a different pair of headphones.
All right.
And if you trace them, by the way, to their origin in the desk over there, you'll find a volume knob.
Oh, cool. cool. Okay.
Yeah. Okay. And before I properly introduce N.K. Jemisin, I do need to make an announcement, and that is this coming Tuesday. I'm still in Saturday mode in my head, right? So I'm saying like in 3 days. No. Mm. Next Tuesday, December 14th. Okay. The New York Review of Science Fiction Readings will feature Ellen Kushner and Delia Sherman. Everybody, it's like everybody in December does the family thing, right? You know, so it's like everybody gather around the tree and let's all do family. And we're doing family as well. Only the family that I have chosen are Ellen and Delia. Mm-hmm. This is the third out of fourth year they're doing the December reading, which is way cool. And the only problem with it is that it wasn't four out of four. And the I guess they are married in Massachusetts, but not New York.
Oh, okay.
Because they did have a.
I knew they were married. I wasn't sure.
They were married in Mass. Although I think now it's recognized in New York, isn't it?
I don't know. They changed the law. Every
you can't
other
get
minute.
Married in New York, but I think if you were married elsewhere as a same-sex couple, then it's recognized in New York taxes and all that.
Okay.
Good stuff.
Of course,
you get to
for
pay
taxes.
More taxes.
Of course, for taxes. Yes.
Well, yeah,
yes. They're going to find a way to do it for taxes.
Ellen Kushner is a novelist, performer, and public radio personality, sound and spirit, yes, whose award-winning novels include the Manor Punk cult classic Swords Point and Thomas the Rhymer. Ellen
Fantastic
put on her
book.
Blog. Yeah, well, the reading is all going to be from Swords Point. Okay. Not from Swords Point, from the same world. Unpublished new Swords Point stories that continue the characters.
Ooh.
Yes.
Okay.
This is like last year she read, not The Man with Knives. It was just published at Tor.com.
I saw that, but I haven't read that one yet.
Yeah. The Man with the Knives, something along those lines. She read that for us last year. Mm-hmm. It was then published 5 months later and has now been released in a limited edition, now released to the public at Tor.com. Mm-hmm. But if you went to the reading last December, you got it first, okay? She has done The Golden Dreidel. There's that word again. A Klezmer Nutcracker.
I saw that last year. It was great.
And it's on a CD, and it's a chapter book. It was the New York Vital Theater did it. She hosts the National Public Radio series, PRI Sound and Spirit, available online. It's not really broadcast anymore. New projects include a YA anthology, Welcome to Bordertown. Some future show you will hear about why Bordertown is one of my favorite shared universes of all time. You haven't read the Bordertown books?
No.
There's about five of them.
Mm-hmm.
It's the crossing point between Elfland and the human world, where magic doesn't really work quite the way it's supposed to, and science doesn't really work quite the way it's supposed to. Things break down. It's right in the middle of the sort of a barrier. And outcast elvish princes go there and runaways.
And it's a shared world?
It's a shared world. Oh. There are about three anthologies, one of which has about five writers who are either Terry Windling or Ellen Kushner under different pseudonyms.
Okay.
And it's just this wonderful series. Fanishly,
really
I drew
cool.
on that. It really is. Yeah. So there, it's been dormant for about 12 years. Will Shetterly, Emma Bull, all these people have written for Delia Sherman, of course, before she and Ellen, I think, were a couple. And just fabulous, fabulous stuff. So when that book comes out, well, you'll know. Ellen is currently producing, just recorded, a musical radio drama, The Witches of Lublin, which I actually saw and recorded for Ellen, not for the radio, but for Ellen, an undress rehearsal, what do you call radio rehearsal? a run-through with a preview audience of about 50 people. It's really interesting. It stars Tova Felcha and Simon Jones. Now, for those who don't know, Simon Jones, of course, is the original Arthur Dent from The Hitchhiker's Guide to the Galaxy.
That sounded familiar.
And he's a Broadway actor. He's a wonderful actor who listens to WBAI. He's heavily into radio, and he lives in New York. Oh, you see, it just...
He could be listening just right
it
now.
It just did it. I haven't muted my phone. Oh. And it just dreidled at me. I've told
Puzzle tough.
Yes, exactly. No, I had this in a breast pocket once, right near the microphone, last January. Mm-hmm. And I was talking, I was eulogizing Cage Baker, who had just died. Mm-hmm. And on the words uterine cancer, the phone said dried. Oh, and I was like, oh my God.
Yeah, bad timing.
That was really was. But Cage would have loved it.
Well, that's good.
She had that kind of sense of humor. She wouldn't have liked the phone.
Mm. Too many doodads.
Well, I mean, she was technically with it, but, you know, it wasn't her style, I don't think. Mm-hmm. Anyway, Delia Sherman. Oh, yes, the Witches of Lublin is for public radio's spring 2011 holiday broadcast. So, spring. Oh, yeah, so Pesach, Passover. Mm-hmm. Okay, she lives in New York City with Delia Sherman and no cats. And she's at ellenkushner.com. Delia Sherman. A veteran of the Nursif readings, is a writer of historical folklore, semi-comic fairy stories with a serious twist. Her short fiction and poetry have appeared most recently in The Beastly Bride and Poe. Her adult novels are Through a Brazen Mirror, The Porcelain Dove, which won the Mythopoeic Award, and is a wonderful book. And with fellow fantasist Ellen Kushner, The Fall of the Kings, which they read first, also about a year before it was published at a Nursif reading. Which was done by Amy Goldschlager, was the curator, the regular curator of the series at the time. Well, on and on and on and on. This is what it comes down to is this. Next Tuesday at the Soho Gallery for Digital Art at 134 Sullivan Street. If you want more information, go to ourwolf.com, ourwolf.com, and you can click on the link about the reading series. There's also a link for this radio show and all kinds of stuff. And yes, yes, I know it's old, but Chris Dykeman and Matt Kressel are redoing the site against my will, but they're going to do a wonderful job. The next day... We really try to keep the KGB reading series and the Nursif readings apart.
Hmm.
But this Tuesday, a couple of days ago, when we would have done our reading, a memorial.
Right.
For I screw up his last name, so I don't want to say it. Ralph.
Vicinanza. Yeah, I do that too.
And so we didn't want to conflict with that. It just wouldn't be right. Oh, I didn't mention the curator for this for next Tuesday's reading is Claire Wolfe Smith, who was the second or third curator of the series from 1994 through 1996, and she will be hosting and taking care of all the ceremonial duties. I'll introduce the thing. You can't get rid of me, but then it's Claire's show.
Hmm. Okay.
And she's wonderful. So normally we're the first Tuesday and KGB is the third Wednesday. We had to be the second Tuesday this month. And of course the third Wednesday is the following night.
Right.
Because it was the 1st, the 8th, and the 15th, right?
Well, this time of year it's almost unavoidable to have those kinds of conflicts though. There's always going to be something that's
So we try to put a buffer between them, the same way we try not to have the same guests in a certain period of time. But it just happens that the Nursif reading is on the Tuesday, the KGB reading is the following night. But I know that if you're listening now, you've got the wherewithal to attend both. And if you are really sturdy, looky, Facebook. If you're really sturdy, okay, they've got two people, Beth Brnovich, who's a wonderful writer, who I met at a couple of reader cons. I didn't realize she's in New York now.
Oh,
I think she is. I'm not sure.
Is she? I mean, I used positive. To know her when she lived in Massachusetts and when I lived in Massachusetts.
Right.
And I've suggested that she check out KGB and try and get involved with that. I didn't realize that she had moved down here, though.
Well, I'm not positive about that, but if she has, she's going to have to do this
great news.
Darn show.
Yeah.
But poor John Armstrong. John Armstrong, whose new novel, Yarn, is just out, who did a reading for Nursif last spring, and a really good one. He read with Tobias Bukel. And he is going to be reading at KGB next Wednesday. And then he's going to stay awake.
And do this?
And then he will be our guest.
Wow. Okay.
So.
He's going to need the high test coffee that day.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. And I'm going to accompany. I'm going to do the KGB. I'll record it as I always do. And then we're going to figure out a way to keep John and I awake. Keep just John and me
start
awake.
Mainlining it around yeah, like
exactly.
7 o'clock.
Yeah, exactly. Mm-hmm. Exactly. That's the deal. Mm-hmm. So, and listeners will. Okay. Thank you. Those are the announcements. So KGB is at 185 East 4th Street. No.
Yeah, it's East 4th Street.
No, it is 4th Street.
Yeah, it is.
Yeah, okay. Mm-hmm. It's at the KGB bar. Mm-hmm. You go to kgbfantasticfiction.net. That's Google KGB Fantastic Fiction. And you will find the reading series. Attend. Attend mine. Attend them. Have a great 48 hours of live science fiction readings. And by the way, meeting at these events, the coolest people. And the KGB readings and the NYRSF readings are actually very different. I consider the ones that I produce to be sort of a stage, not a stage presentation. You did it this year.
They're a little more formal, I'd say.
They're a little more formal. It's a little more podium to audience. It's a little more of a proscenium type feeling, where the KGB readings are more like a salon.
They're also a lot more interactive just because of the upstairs theater.
Oh, God help us.
And the stomping, the random sound effects that are going to occur throughout the reading.
Which is why I could any number of recordings that I've made have been ruined by the Morris dancing, clod-hopping nonsense.
On the other hand, it makes for a really... it's a lively reading. I mean, you end up having these random sound effects at completely inappropriate times in the middle of the reading, just have to find a way to incorporate them. They end up kind of enriching the story somehow.
Which I could never bear. Since I took over the series, I've made sure that between the South Street Seaport and the Soho Gallery, that we are in a sound-friendly environment.
Right.
Because the recordings of these are important to me. And I've started, by the way, videotaping ours. You're on video. I recorded you on the flip, yeah.
Oh, my gosh.
And
I didn't have makeup on. Oh, no.
Right. But what I haven't done yet is I haven't married the sound to the video. Because I'm recording through a professional recorder and through the video cam. And I need somebody who really understands production, Terrence Taylor, that's you, to show me how to use the software to wed the two together. So I need a professional producer like Terrence Taylor.
Gosh, I don't know. You might want to try talking to Terrence Taylor. I'm not sure where that idea came to me from.
Oh, yeah. I have no idea whatsoever. Yeah. It must have been...
Zeitgeist.
Oh, God. He and I were geeking out at Fairway. He and I, when we shopped...
You were geeking at the Fairway? That just sounds like a great story title.
It is.
Geeking at
the
Fairway.
Well, we're food fans.
Okay.
It's, you know, that's it. We're food. We like...
What were you geeking over?
The food.
Like
shopping
in particular? Or
It's every aisle, every item. It's like, oh my God, Meyer lemons.
Really?
You can get Meyer lemons right now. And I have a friend who actually used to be like not editor-in-chief, but she was in charge of NAL, New American Library. David Hartwell and Terry Bisson reported to her. Okay. And she talks to me nonstop about Meyer lemons.
They are wonderful.
I had never had
the fragrance.
One.
Oh, really?
I had never had one.
Oh, those
and
are
so and so that's an example of what we were geeking about.
Gotcha.
We're bins of Meyer lemons.
Wow.
So I got a lot. I got a lot.
Yeah, they're so aromatic.
They're really nice. I had my first one earlier tonight.
Fantastic. What did you did you put it on something or
I sliced half of it, and Barbara and I each had just ate it.
Yeah, they're actually sweet enough that they're delicious on their own.
Yeah, yeah. And then the other half went into iced tea.
Oh, ooh, oh, that sounds fun. Yeah. You should try that sometime.
And given that I don't sugar my iced tea, it was that extra little bit of flavor that's really nice.
Great.
So imagine that on every aisle with every product.
Sounds like a Food Network show
waiting
to happen.
Well, it sort of was. Actually, it's a great idea for a Food Network show.
People at the Food Network, please notice.
Yes, and they could do it at the Chelsea Market right beneath the food, which I've still never been to.
That's true.
Right beneath the Food Network. You know, people shopping through the aisles and talking about the availability and what you can do with these foods and throw together a concoction.
I'd watch it.
That's a great idea for a show.
I'd watch it.
Alton Brown, take note.
And see if you can get it on right after Alton Brown, and there you go.
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah, get him to produce it. Terrence and I will host.
Oh, that would be wonderful.
Wouldn't it?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Anyway, Nora Jemison is, well, you know, a wonderful writer. Her second novel is in print.
Yep.
A third novel is forthcoming, which is nothing compared to a huge announcement.
Yes. So I had been holding off on hoping to have the chance to announce this on Hour of the Wolf, but...
She actually got her editor to make an announcement on Orbit Books' website, on a blog.
So that I could do it today.
Just so that you could do... Because they had to break the news first, right? But this is the official announcement.
Yes, so the official announcement is that I have sold two more books to Orbit Books. The Dreamblood duology will be forthcoming. Everything is still a little bit tentative, but as far as we know, things will be coming out in mid-2012. They are two books. They are finished, so they will probably be coming out back-to-back.
Isn't it wonderful to have it already done?
Yes. Yes, actually.
Wow.
That's incredible, quite frankly. They are set in a sort of fantasy ancient Egypt and involve a ancient Egypt-like society. It was one of my attempts to kind of do more traditional fantasy than the Inheritance trilogy is. But there's still some pieces of it that I think, you know, traditional fantasy and I have a fraught relationship. I
was just talking with Sydney Smith about that before the show, as I was pointing out, for those who come to the WBAI book fair, that there are multiple copies of Jonathan Strange and Mr. Norrell available. For like $5 each. And this is the hardcover. I thought a wonderful book. It's not an easily penetrable book, as Nora knows. But but if you can take the time, it was for me about 6 weeks. You need that. You need that. It is immersive. And if you're living a life that's filled with many things, you may not be able to devote that time to it. But if you can, it's brilliant. But Sydney said, I don't read fantasy. And then it's like, well, I don't read traditional fantasy. You know, not the dragons, not this, not that. And I suspect you feel similarly.
Well, I have nothing against dragons. I am actually interested in most of the tropes of traditional fantasy. It's a combination of settings that are too familiar and storytelling formats that are too familiar.
Because if one reads the Inheritance trilogy, one would know that here is a unique voice.
Well, I try. You know,
By the way, the Inheritance trilogy is the 100,000 Kingdoms. By the way, I'm doing this without notes. Okay, this is fanboy talking. Okay. And having said that, now I'm blanking on...
The Broken Kingdom.
I knew it was broken, yeah.
Yes. And the third one is The Kingdom of Gods. That one won't be out until October 2011, I think.
Right. And in brief, how do we describe these books? Don't fall in love with a god.
That's actually stated in the story. You know, be really careful who you fall in love with. And you know, gods in particular, but, you know, just bad people in general.
Any Karen Lord? Have you read her novel?
I've got her novel at home. It's in my massive pile of books to read. I actually bought it and got it signed by her at the Brooklyn Book Festival, where we finally got a chance to meet.
That's right. You were both appearing
on
one
panel. We were both
on
a panel at the Brooklyn. Yeah, it was horrible, but we had a full house. So And there were lots of people that asked questions about her work.
That was, of course, because of my broadcast before
Okay. All right.
Oh, God, is she like one of the best guests?
She's a great person. She's wonderful. I just loved meeting her. So I can't wait to read the book, but I have 20 books ahead of it. So and because while I was writing The Broken Kingdoms and Kingdom of Gods, I was in like hardcore all the world is nothing but books mode, you know, and doing nothing but writing and, you know, kind of throwing my social life, what little there is, off to the side.
Ouch.
And yeah, well, you know, you have to make sacrifices. I sacrifice for my art, blah, blah, blah. Was working on almost exclusively writing, and the pile of books to read just kept piling and piling and piling. So now that I have a little bit more free time, I am working my way slowly through it. But I'm actually starting work on another epic fantasy, so I'm not ready to talk about that one yet. It doesn't have enough solidity to discuss before my ideas sort of gel enough or are cured enough. I don't feel comfortable exposing them to the air just yet.
Right.
So that's further down the pipe. The ideas are just kind of coming. They're cranking themselves out.
But what is wonderful to me is while you're writing these epic long immersive works, you're not shy of writing fabulous Nebula and Hugo nominated short stories.
Well, the short stories are actually a pleasant break from the big sweeping epic fantasy, you know, drama. You know,
but some of them are perfect. I mean, I'm you know, perhaps largely because of trying to fit a short story into a 2-hour, 90-minute format.
Gotcha.
And trying to present fiction to listeners, but also because I love them, and I grew up in the era of the Digest magazines, where, you know, the Rod Serling era, where the short story was king, and I love them as gems, and you are in that tradition.
Oh, well, that's great to hear. I did not grow up in any short story tradition. I did not read short stories or write them until the year 2002, when I went to Viable Paradise. And I've told this story before, but I had sort of snootily decided that, you know, I'm a novelist and, you know, short stories are a different art form and I'm not going to bother with that other art form. I don't need to learn how to do that. I need to perfect my existing art. And the folks at Viable Paradise were like, "What's wrong with you? Wake up." And they didn't hit me. They were very nice. But, you know, they gave me the mental equivalent of a backhand slap and said, you know, no, that's completely wrong. Yes, they are different art forms, but they complement one another. And the thing that they told me, which sort of cinched it, I think this was Teresa Nielsen Hayden who said this, was, you know, writing short stories will actually improve your novel writing, will make your novel writing more succinct, more to the point.
Teresa Nielsen Hayden is a smart cookie.
Yes, yes. So, and that sort of made a light bulb go off, and I said, okay, you know, I will try this in order to improve my novel, still snootily. And then discovered as I started practicing, you know, in writing short stories, that I actually really loved it. And now I use short stories as a means of sort of breaking the stress of writing novels. In fact, you know, while I was working on book 3, The Kingdom of Gods, I actually, you know, went through this period of like short story withdrawal because I was on a deadline.
Yeah.
I had to finish book 3. I could not take a break to write some short stories, and short story ideas were zinging me from left and right. So, you know, I really, really wanted to stop and work on some, but I just had to, you know, jot down the idea as much as I could, set it aside, and now I'm in, like, short story binge mode.
Oh, so, cool.
Yeah, so I actually have a new one coming out in Weird Tales. I'm not sure. I'm sorry?
You know what issue? About when?
Approximately. The next one.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, I can't remember what the actual number.
Yeah, don't care about the number. The upcoming issue.
Yes, the upcoming issue.
And we will mark that this is December of 2010. Because hopefully people are listening to this later after we get a podcast going and stuff. So.
Okay. So, yes, I have a short story coming out called The Trojan Girl in that one, which is me dabbling in cyberpunk. Although one of my
write science fiction as well as fantasy, we need to point out to people.
Yeah, yeah.
Stories like Non-Probability Zero.
Right, non-zero probabilities. It's okay. It's fine.
Can we tell very briefly the torture that you were put through that I was witness to about that story?
What
last May, I think it was, or was it April?
I'm not sure.
It was the Nebula Award.
Oh, yeah. That was...
Let me explain. And by the way, sometime, mm-hmm. I will never make this public, but I will share it with you. Barbara and I have this on film.
The whole, hours?
No.
Oh.
The crucial 5 minutes.
Oh, okay.
Look, okay, John Ordover, proprietor of the Soho Gallery of Digital Art, you know, was selling and made available tickets so that people could watch a simulcast of the Nebula Awards. Mm-hmm. Nora was nominated, but mm-hmm. could not go to Florida where it was being held.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And so now the ceremony was endless, and it went on and on and on, including one fellow who got up at Cape Canaveral talking about what I did on my summer vacation for about half an hour.
Mm.
And the emeritus speech and the Dadlow, get your annual awards and, you know, all this.
Award ceremonies are always interminable, though. So,
well, I've attended Nebulas that were under an hour.
Oh.
Mm. Now, that was the 70s, but when they were always in New York, actually. Oh. Mm. Come back. But they're actually in Washington this coming year, so they're actually accessible.
Okay.
I will be there. I will be there doing interviews.
Ah, excellent.
Officially through CEFWA, through the Science Fiction Writers of America. Mm-hmm. I will have my own place where writers can come in and be interviewed. Mm. I did this in 2007, and it has been arranged that I will be doing this again.
Mm.
Way cool. Anyway. Mm-hmm. So they're doing this thing. Nora is sitting there. Enough people had left because, you know, the food was gone. The local banquet was over. The stuff on the screen was interminable. And we weren't paying any attention anymore. We were all talking. And finally, after like 3.5 hours.
I think it was more like four.
It was 4 hours because the thing started at 6.
Yeah, yeah.
And it was about 10 o'clock, 10:15 or so, that they get around to the short story category. And the presenter, who was the grandmaster, now I'm forgetting who it was a wonderful writer in his late 70s.
I cannot remember.
Whose eyesight was failing. So that it was, and he had to do a long presentation and took time for him to read the nominees.
Mm.
And then he says, and at this point, there's like 8 people left to watch this thing. And the only reason that any of us are there, that the proprietor kept the place open is because one of the nominees was there. And we suspected we knew who the winner was, Keach Johnson. But nevertheless, it doesn't matter.
Yeah.
You still. Yeah. Saladin Ahmed knew he wouldn't win. That didn't stop him from going to Florida. You know, you do what you can if you can afford. Blah 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 blah.
Right.
Twinsy. Anyway, the Saladin, you have to do this show before you leave for Detroit. Okay.
Yes, Saladin, you do.
Yeah. And he knows it. He knows it. He won't say it, but he knows it. Yeah. So there comes a point where it's just interminable, and he says, and the winner is, and Nora jumped into the air and just say it. This was, our hearts were out. Our hearts were like, oh my God, the torture, the sheer absolute torture at this point in a young career. And a Nebula, I mean, you win the Nebula Award, this is cool, but there will be other times. I hear people out there, won awards, and Ordover did one of the classiest things I've ever seen him do. He presented you with that little
it's a little carousel. It's the cutest thing.
Of rocket
still
ships.
Have it. Yes, it's the cutest thing.
You know, and that was
mm-hmm.
So what we have is the jumping, just say it, and the presentation. Mm-hmm. I have that on film. So
it really is an honor to be nominated because I'd never expected to be nominated at this stage of my career. You know, I thought it was just too soon. I did not know enough yet about, you know, short story writing. I was not that accomplished as short story writers go, or at least I didn't think I was. And then, you know, suddenly I get nominated and I'm like, whoa, all right. And since I was nominated, I decided that I was going to go whole hog into it. and really just kind of get into it and enjoy it and love it as much as possible. So, you know, that was pretty much how it went.
Oh. Yeah. No, I just wanted to close the door because there was some noise out there. Now I see it was Lister. Uh-huh. You can open the door again. You can prop it open again. He's here. He's on at 3 a.m.
Oh, okay.
And with a show that everybody listening now will stay tuned to because it's a bleeping great show. And by the way, Nora, take note of how much clothes this guy is wearing, because in an hour, there's going to be very little of that left.
Oh, okay.
If it wasn't radio, people, the FCC would have words to say about your attire, sir. Anyway, it's a very different time slot than Hour of the Wolf.
It's a lot livelier around here.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
But with great people at either end of this program. Mm-hmm. Not that Hobday and Simon weren't great.
Oh, yeah, they were great. It was just, you know, it was 5 in the morning, so.
Well, it's a different dynamic.
Yeah.
It's a different dynamic. Mm. Well, you see, the thing is that in analyzing the stories, which, you know, I'm a handicapper. Sitting there making predictions about who will win what awards and this and that. And the Hugo's cool, but the Hugo's a fan award. You know, not to put it down, but it's a peer award. It's a fan award and all that. The Nebulas are the Academy Awards of the science fiction and fantasy world. Because it's given out by your peers.
By the other authors that are active members of SIFWA.
Yeah.
Although, actually, I think, what is the – step.
I'm an associate.
Associate, yes.
I'm an associate member, which means I can nominate, but I can't vote.
Right. So, but the final voting was done by the actual members. But,
Right. You
know, they did some different things with the voting this year, and I think that resulted in a really, really good pool of people. You know, a pool that was, I've seen some analyses of the pool and that, you know, it's a little younger than usual.
Well, that was a very interesting thing.
Yeah.
That there were
more
new
diverse
people
in terms
and faces,
of gender
names
and
like
race
Nora Jemison and Saladin Ahmed. These are not names that would have appeared. You know, you didn't have black women and Turkish guys. Turkish descent, anyway. I mean, he's from Detroit. He's not
Turkish.
Yeah,
he's from Detroit, really.
Yeah, really. Yeah. But it's like, you know, I'm German. I'm born in New York, but I'm German, you know. So he's Turkish. So under those rules.
But, yeah. Okay.
And well, you know, do you think it's time to read? Yeah.
I can.
Do you want to break first or after?
On this
format of the show, there's not too many breaks.
Why don't I read a segment? I have a shorter segment and a longer segment.
Of
The Broken Kingdoms.
Which is part two of?
Part two of the Inheritance Trilogy.
In print from?
Orbit Books. Okay.
Edited by Davey.
Edited by Davey Pillai.
I mean, you have to say, and I only met her that one time, that night. I met her that
night at
the
Nebula
Awards,
yes,
dinner after. And boy, is she cool.
Yeah, she's a ton of fun. Yeah, she went out and got some beer for us that night, which also made the ceremony go a little better.
Yes.
I have two segments that I think I can read from, one relatively short and one a little bit longer if we have the time to do that. And I will say that both of the books that are out so far for the Inheritance Trilogy are standalone. Or are sort of made to be standalone. It certainly helps if you have read the first book before you tackle the second, because there are several really key pieces of information that the protagonist of the second book does not know, but which readers of the first book would know. There's a sort of interesting dynamic going on in this book in which readers know much more than the protagonist throughout the first half of the book. But I can read from a piece. Do you want me to go ahead without the break, or do you want to do the break first?
No. It's your choice because you're the one who has to read. My question for you is, do you have enough liquid?
Can I bring you some clear water? Choked up on coffee. No, actually, water would be good.
Yeah,
yes.
I'll bring you some water
while you're reading.
And the question, and then the second question is,
thank
you, sir.
Okay, thanks a lot.
I was trying to read his T-shirt, which
Something about Angola.
Something about Angola.
Yeah.
And I'm don't run. You'll get hurt.
Where is he going?
He just went to get water.
Okay.
He's an amazing spirit, this guy.
And fast.
Oh, yeah. And the other question is, since you mentioned two pieces, it's author's choice. If you want to read both, do you want to do one and then the other, or do you want to break after the first?
I think it's a good idea to break after the first.
Excellent.
There's a mood shift.
Oh.
So, okay. Yeah, so that might be a good way to do
and
it.
And we're all queued up, by the way.
Okay, I'll let you know.
Requested music.
All right, I'll let you know as soon as I'm done. But the first piece should be roughly 10 minutes.
Yeah, but just give me a visual cue and the music will magically appear.
Okay. Now, just to sort of preface this piece, this is starting at page 70 of The Broken Kingdom, so we're a few chapters into it. Excuse me. The Broken Kingdoms is set in a city called Shadow, which sits in the shadow of a gigantic tree, which is why they call it Shadow. And so Shadow is a strange place. It's kind of like New York on the Twilight Zone. And so there are godlings living in this city. They're demigods, basically, that have decided to come and live among humankind just for various reasons. Some of them are easy to spot because they're clearly inhuman, and some of them just kind of live in among the regular people. And so Ori Shoth is the protagonist. She's the narrator of this. Ori is a young woman who is blind, but she has the peculiar ability to see magic. And she, like most young people who come to New York, came from a smaller town, came to the City of Shadow kind of just seeking her fortune, and decided that she wanted to come here and be an artist, basically. So she's going to narrate a story of how she met her godling boyfriend. So it's kind of, think of this as Sex in the City with gods. And no profanity. So, it's actually fairly tame.
Oh, shucks.
That's very tame. Yes, you told me about the seven words. Okay, so let's get right into it. Let me tell you how Madding and I met. I came to Shadow when I was 17. Very quickly, I fell in with others like me. Newcomers, dreamers, young people drawn to the city in spite of its dangers because sometimes, for some of us, tedium and familiarity feel worse than risking your life. With their help, I learned to make a living off my knack for crafts and to protect myself from those who would have exploited me. I slept in a tenement with six others at first, then got an apartment of my own. After a year's time, I sent a letter to my mother letting her know I was alive and received a 10-page missive demanding that I come home in return. I was doing well. I remember it was the end of the day, and winter time. Snow is rare and light in the city. The tree protects us from the worst of it. But there had been some, and it was cold enough for the cobbled paths to become icy death traps. 2 days, excuse me, 2 days before, Veroy, one of her fellow artists, had fractured his arm falling, much to the dismay of Rue and Owen, his husband and wife, respectively, who had to put up with his incessant complaining at home. I had no one at home to take care of me if I fell, so I couldn't afford a bone bender, so I went everywhere even more slowly than usual on the sidewalks. Ice sounds much like stone when tapped with a walking stick, but there is a subtle difference to the air above a patch. It is not only colder, but also palpably heavier. I was safe enough, just slow. But because I was so intent on not breaking a limb, I paid less attention to my route than I should have, and given that I was still relatively new to the city, I got lost. Shadow is not a good city to get lost in. The city had grown haphazardly over the centuries, springing up at the foot of Sky the Palace, and its layout made little sense despite the constant efforts of the nobles to impose order on the mess. Long-time denizens tell me it's even worse since the growth of the tree, which bifurcated the city into West Shadow and East Shadow, Weisha and Isha, and caused other, more magical changes. The lady, the goddess who created the giant tree, had been kind enough to keep the tree from destroying anything when it grew, but entire neighborhoods had been shifted out of place, old streets erased and new ones created, landmarks moved. Get lost and one could wander in circles for hours. That was not the real danger, however. I noticed it quickly that chilly afternoon. Someone was following me. The steps trailed 20 or so feet behind, keeping pace. I turned a corner and hoped, to no avail. Excuse me. The feet moved with me. I turned again. The same. Thieves, probably. Rapists and killers didn't care much for the cold. I had little money on me, and I did not look wealthy by any stretch, but most likely it was enough that I looked alone and lost and blind. That made me easy pickings on a day when the pickings would be slim. I did not walk faster, though of course I was afraid. Some thieves didn't like leaving witnesses. But to hurry would let this thief know he had been spotted, and worse, I might still break my neck. Better to let him come, give him what he wanted, and hope that would be enough. Except he wasn't coming. I walked a block, two blocks, three. I heard few other people on the street, and those few were moving quickly, some of them muttering about the cold and paying no attention to anything but their misery. For long stretches, there was only me and my pursuer. Now he will come, I thought, several times, but there was no attack. As I turned my head for a better listen, something glinted at the corner of my vision. Startled, in those days I was not quite used to seeing magic, I forgot wisdom, stopped, and turned to see. My pursuer was a young woman. She was plump, short, with curly, pale green hair and skin of a nearly similar shade. That alone would have alerted me as to her nature, though it was obvious in the fact that I could see her. She stopped when I did. I noticed that her expression was very sad. She said nothing, so I ventured, "Hello." Her eyebrows rose. "You can see me." I frowned a bit. "Yes, you're standing right there." "How interesting." She resumed walking, though she stopped when I took a step back. "If you don't mind me saying so," I said cautiously, "I've never been mugged by a godling." If anything, her expression grew even more mournful. "I mean you no harm. You've been following me since that street back there, the one with the clogged sewer." "Yes." "Why?" "Because you might die," she said. I stumbled back, but only one step, because my heel slipped on a bit of ice alarmingly. "What?" "You will very likely die in the next few moments. It may be difficult, painful. I've come to be with you." She sighed gently. "My nature is mercy. Do you understand?" I had not met many godlings at that point, but anyone who dwelled in shadow for long learned this much. They drew their strength from a particular thing, a concept, a state of being, an emotion. The priests and scriveners called it affinity, though I had never heard any godling use the term. When they encountered their affinity, it drew them like a beacon, and some of them could not quite help responding to it. I swallowed and nodded. You're here to watch me die, or... I shivered as I realized. Or to kill me, if something only does the job halfway. Is that right? She nodded. I'm sorry. And she really did seem sorry, her eyes heavy-lidded, her brow furrowed with the beginnings of grief. She wore only a thin, shapeless shift, more proof of her nature since any mortal would have frozen to death than that. It made her look younger than me, vulnerable, like someone you'd want to stop and help. I shuddered and said, "Well, maybe you could tell me what's going to kill me, and I can walk away from it, and then you won't have to waste any time on me. Would that be all right?" "There are many pathways to any future, but when I am drawn to a mortal, it means most paths have exhausted themselves." My heart, already beating fast, gave an unpleasant little lurch. "You're saying it's inevitable." "Not inevitable, but likely." I needed to sit down. The buildings on either side of me were not residential. I thought they might be storehouses. Nowhere to sit but the cold, hard ground, and for all I knew, doing that might kill me. And that was when I became aware of how utterly quiet it was. There had been three other people on the street two blocks back. Only the green woman's steps had stood out to me for obvious reasons, but now there were no other footfalls at all. The street was completely empty. Yet I could hear something. No, it was not a sound so much as a feeling, a pressure to the air, a lingering whiff of scent, teasingly unidentifiable. And it was behind me. I turned, stumbling again, my heart leaping into my throat as I saw another godling standing across the street. This one was paying no attention to me, however. She looked middle-aged, Islander or Amun, black-haired, ordinary enough, except that I could see her, too. She stood with legs apart and hands fisted at her sides, body taut, an expression of pure fury on her face. When I followed her gaze to see who this fury was directed at, I spied a third person, equally tense but still on my side of the street, closer by. A man. Matting, though I didn't know this at the time. The air between these two godlings was a cloud the color of blood and rage. It curled and shivered, flexing larger and flinching compact with whatever forces they were using against each other, because that was, indeed, what I had walked into, for all that it was silent and still, a battle. One did not need magic-seeing eyes to know that. I licked my lips and glanced back at the green-skinned woman. She nodded. This was how I might die, caught in the crossfire of a duel between gods. Very quickly, as quietly as I could, I began to back up toward the green woman. I didn't think she would protect me. She'd made her interest clear, but there was no other safe direction. I'd forgotten the ice patch behind me. Of course, I slipped and fell, jarring a grunt of pain from my throat and my stick from my hand. It landed on the cobblestones with a loud, echoing clatter. The woman across the street jerked in surprise and looked at me. I had an instant to register that her face was not as ordinary as I'd thought, the skin too shiny, hard smooth like porcelain. Then the stones under me began to shake, and the wall behind me buckled and my skin prickled all over. Suddenly the man was in front of me, opening his mouth to utter a roar like surf crashing into an ocean cave. The porcelain-skinned woman screamed, flinging her arms up as something, I could not see what exactly, shattered around her. That same force flung her backward. I heard mortar crack and crumble as her body struck a wall, then crumpled to the ground. What the heck are you doing? The man shouted at her. Dazed, I stared up at him. A vein in his temple was visible, pounding with his anger. It fascinated me because I hadn't realized godlings had veins. But of course they did. I had not been in the city long, but already I had heard of God's blood. Oh, just a brief explanation. God's blood is what it sounds like, the blood of gods. They've discovered that it is a fantastic intoxicant for mortals. And some gods, namely Ori's boyfriend, sell it as a narcotic, basically. So he's a drug dealer. The woman pushed herself up slowly, though the blow she had taken would have crushed half her bones if she'd been mortal. It did seem to have weakened her as she stayed on one knee while glaring at the man. "You can't stay here," he said, calmer now, though still visibly furious. "You're not careful enough. By threatening this mortal's life, you've already broken the most important rule." The woman's lip curled in a sneer. "Your rule." "The rule agreed upon by all of us who chose to dwell here. None of us wants another interdiction. You were warned." He held up a hand. And suddenly, the street was full of godlings. Everywhere I looked, I could see them. Most looked human, but a few had either shed their mortal guises or had never bothered in the first place. I caught glimpses of skin like metal, hair like wood, legs with animal joints, tentacle fingers. There must have been 2, maybe 3 dozen of them standing in the street or sitting on the curbs. One even flitted overhead on gossamer insect wings. The porcelain-faced woman got to her feet, though she still looked shaky. She looked around at the assemblage of godlings, and there was no mistaking the unease on her face. Excuse me. But she straightened and scowled, pushing her shoulders back. "So this is how you fight your duels?" This was directed at the man. "The duel is over," the man said. He stepped back, closer to me, and then, to my surprise, bent to help me up. I blinked at him in confusion, then frowned as he moved in front of me, blocking my view of the woman. I tried to lean around him to keep an eye on her, since I had a notion she'd almost killed me a moment before, but the man moved with me. "No," he said, "you don't need to see this." "What?" I asked. There was a sound like the tolling of a great bell behind him, followed by a sudden swift concussion of air. Then all the godlings around us vanished. When I craned my head around the man this time, I saw only an empty street. "You killed her," I whispered, shocked. "No, of course not. We opened a door, that's all. Sent her back to our realm. That's what I didn't want you to see." To my surprise, the man smiled, and I was momentarily caught by how human this made him look. "We try not to kill each other. That tends to upset our parents." Before I could stop myself, I laughed. then realized I was laughing with the god and fell silent, which confused me more, so I just stared up at his strangely comforting smile. "Everything all right, Ao?" The man didn't turn from me as he raised his voice to speak. I suddenly remembered the green woman. When I looked at her, I started again. The green woman, Ao apparently, was smiling at me as fondly as a new mother. Her coloring had